We come to the eighth presentation of the 2012 major series. We had four presentations as a set that was a prelude that can go under a separate heading of Our Old Aeon. And that was a parenthetical, symmetrical pairing with a lecture series that I did in 1994 at the Bodhi Tree Bookstore, inaugurating their annex room, which was supposed to join the bookstore and became the annex for the next 17 years. And evidently, I threaded well because it became a great success, and almost every interesting man and woman on the planet seemed to have spoke there. And it's beautiful for me to be able to begin today with something that is current, that has gathered planetary attention, and that is the murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida, the young black teen who was gunned down. And I would like to emphasize that the reason why Trayvon Martin's murder is so incredibly deep is that it has touched an archetypal image. And I would just like to share with you what that image is, and it leads into the presentation today, because it has everything to do with the ancient god figure of Asclepius. Asclepius is the archetypal physician who is the healer, whose great companion was Hygieia, and she in very ancient times was actually held to be his daughter, but she became over the centuries and actually millennia his companion, not his companion as a wife, but his companion as a healer. And it is that archetype, because Asclepius was always accompanied in the formal presentation of his divinity by a little hooded boy named Telephoros. And in this wonderful Bollingen volume by the great Carl Carigny, Asclepios, Archetypal Image of the Physician's Existence, published in the Bollingen series, this was number 3 of 5 in that set, 1959, there is a photo of Telephoros with his hoodie, with his black hoodie. And he is the testament with Asclepius that a healing on an archetypal level must be tendered and delivered. And so Trayvon Taylor is very much the Telephoros of our 2012, that it is time for healing to become deep enough to become real. We're used to thinking in terms of ideas, and two powerful ideas from the early 19th century were put together: the idea of a politics and the idea of an economics. And they were put together as political economy. And that powerful idea ran the 19th century and the 20th century and is still the arbiter of power in the first decade of the 21st century. And all of this is actually psychologically a delusion. And so what we're looking at here in the Hermetic Bodhisattvas 2012 presentation series is patiently re-emerging, not re-layering, but re-emerging the great planetary wisdom tradition of the last 2,000-year time form, incumbent upon us to appreciate more than understand initially, but to appreciate, because in the aesthetic of being able to personally appreciate the prismatic art of spirit person making and sharing, we bring ourselves to the great kaleidoscopic process, which is not a subject to be taught at a school, but actually is a dimension of consciousness, and that is history. Because with the dimension of history, in active play, in the prismatic spirit person, communities, however small as a seed, has the ability to resonate in terms of the field out of which consciousness is generated, and that field is infinite. And that infinite field of differential consciousness, we can give a phase name of vision. And just as art comes out of two braided qualities that vision possesses, one is creative imagining, the other is remembering. And with creative imagining being the somewhat dominant, one has the remembering element supporting the creative imagining, and out of vision, in that way, art becomes a phase and also a dimension. Because when one comes out of an infinite field, you not only have a transform from natural seasons to phases, but you have a second transformation, which is a distillation, where the phases now can also be understood increasingly as dimensions. And in the pairing of a natural cycle and a conscious ecology, one begins to understand something that we read last week, and that is an excerpt which not only appears in the Hermetica, but also appears in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And it is the 64th chapter of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And it's interesting for us to understand that when the Egyptian Book of the Dead came out, it came out about 2000 BC and came out exactly at the time where there was a massive genius carrier wave that brought in a new time form. And that new time form stood for the 2000-year period from 2000 BC to 0 BC. It not only was the Egyptian Book of the Dead being put into a papyrus and the large Heliopolitan recension, the papyrus of Ani that's in the British Museum is quite enormous and huge, but to put it not only into a papyrus roll like that to become the Egyptian Book of the Dead, it had a reference wave 350 years before that. And that reference wave was the pyramid built by the pharaoh Wenes, or sometimes it used to be pronounced and written as Unas, but Wenes is correct. And that pyramid was the first time that hieroglyphics were put inside a pyramid, so that the inner architecture of the pyramid was a literate pilgrimage to the coffin, to the sarcophagus. And that pilgrimage was a pilgrimage that would be taken not so much physically or psychically, but spiritually, so that one's spirit could always take that pilgrimage again with deeper and deeper understanding and insight. And that pyramid was 2350 BC, contemporaneous with Sargon of Akkad, who established the first international civilization. There were kingdoms, yes. There were collections of kingdoms. There were cities, there were collections of cities. They were dwarfed by Sargon of Akkad. When I was a student 60-some years ago, we were told that it was called the Fertile Crescent from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea. But actually, Sargon extended it out past Cyprus into almost the Aegean area and extended it all the way to the Indus civilizations in India. And so that spread at almost 4,400 years ago was the first time that human beings in a concerted way had to adjust to hundreds of kingdoms, to scores of languages, and to have some kind of a common denominator across the board of humanity. And it taught that population of people for the first time that there is a whole spectrum of common denominators for human beings. And the idea then was put forth as there is such a thing as a king, but now there is such a person as a king of kings. And that was the beginnings, as the reference wave with the Pyramid of Menes at 2350 BC for the 2000 BC to be such a powerful carrier wave, because the inheritor of Sargon of Akkad was the first patriarch of the Old Testament, Abraham, born about 2000 BC. And came through in such a way that he was able to vision clearly at about 75 years of age that there was a spiritual place that his pilgrimage would have to go to, a promised land, and that this promised land would be able to have engraved in a spiritual hieroglyphic the generations of men and women who would be able to live in that promised land pyramid with the hieroglyphics of their lives, person by person, generation by generation, and that that would build, the yogic word is tapas, it will build an energy which will increase itself, and by the time of a time form running its complete age, a new era, a new age, a new aeon, to use the Greek word for those large bi-millennial time forms, that those people in the new aeon would be lifted up, literally boosted up, by the helper energy, which would be distributed in spiritual helpers and guardians. And from Abraham to 0 BC, one reads the very first sentence in the New Testament, Jesus, son of David, son of Abraham. And Matthew, quite a sophisticated, powerful individual, really someone, was able to see that each of the eras from Abraham to David was 14 generations. And then in the next millennium, it paired so that there were 14 generations up to the taking away, the exile, and 14 generations from the exile to the birth of Jesus, so that one began to get a kind of geometry that Pythagoras called history. And the reason why he called history geometry is that one learns to proportion not just time as a numerical location in the universe, but deeper because of its spiritual emergence with conscious dimensions added to it. It is possible then to carry the understanding with the added third dimension of history into a fourth dimension, which is an analytic, which is science. And with science, one now has a mathematic analytic to be able to understand that the energy of time has the primal quality of sustaining the universe. Time is energy, which spontaneously comes out of the zero field of nature, does not have a thing as an antecedent, but occurs spontaneously and in such a way that the spontaneity engenders in time the ability to be instantaneous. And with instantaneousness, realization is possible even in the universe. And the realization is that eternity is quite real, and it sustains not just a universe, but a whole cosmos, which has conscious dimensions as well. So that one reads in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Here it is. This is from the first of three volumes on Thrice Greatest Hermes by G.R.S. Meade, George Robert Stowe Meade, who was the last secretary for Madame Blavatsky and who became one of the great religious translating geniuses of all time. The nature of this symbolic agdode, which means an eight-part or eight-phase structure, is most clearly seen in the inscription at Deir el-Bahari, that is, across the River Nile from Thebes, Luxor, where Queen Hatshepsut built Deir el-Bahari in about 1500 BC, a very powerful time. In it, the Osirified says to the Supreme, I am one who becomes two. Two who becomes four. I am four who becomes eight. I am the one after that. So that one sees the geometry of history, that there is an integral, a unity, which becomes tunable as a two, which proportion the oneness, but in a new way, in a fertile way, because just as the one has become two, the two can pair again and become two pairs, become four. And when one understands proportionally, it's not four, it's a pair of pairs, so that there is a symmetry to symmetry. There's a tunability to tunability, so that the finer tunability is through quaternaries. And because it's through quaternaries, one now has the ability to have frames of reference which are capable of being used in an analytic later on as one acquires the mathematic of understanding the geometry of history by including the four that become eight, because now it's not just a pair of pairs, it's pairedness cubed, which is eight. It's a pair of fours, so that the space-time four dimensions of the universe have a symmetry with four dimensions of differential consciousness in its ecology, and those together making that eight. There is another after that, which is the complementarity of both fours brought together, so that one now has a new dimension, a ninth dimension. And in the classic Hermetica, one of the manuscripts, one of the books that was purposely lost in the 4th century, in the 300s AD, was The Eighth Reveals the Ninth. And that was recovered in Egypt in jars that held 13 codexes called the Nag Hammadi manuscripts, and The Eighth Reveals the Ninth was found whole there. The Eighth Revealing the Ninth also is the classic way in which Plotinus taught, as one of the greatest figures in the world for wisdom teaching. And when he passed on, he died in Rome about 269, almost 270 AD. He died of an outbreak in Rome of diphtheria. His great helper, like a graduate student helper, Porphyry. Porphyry means royal purple. He was from Tyre on the coast of the Mediterranean, and Tyre had been for millennia one of the great rich trading cities in the world. It was the shipping port of the Phoenicians, and its capital was raised by taking the shells of certain marine snails, and you could make a dye which was the royal purple. And so his name, Porphyry, when he went to put together the writing down of the remembrance of Plotinus in his lecturing, he always lectured in his own villa home in Rome. It's an ancient wisdom tradition. One teaches from where one lives. He arranged the sets of Plotinus's presentation into what are called Aeneids, that is, nine presentations as a set. But not just one nine, but six nines, so that you have the ability then to learn wisdom in higher and higher geometry. One can read now, or read out loud now, so that Plotinus speaks again, but not just giving a treatise, not just giving a presentation, but giving presentations that make sets, and sets that then are able to have an even higher geometry, which is a harmonic. And with that 6 times 9, that 54 double set, one has the presentation, one has the Aeneid, one has the Aeneids, plural. And this is an ancient technique and time form. Not only the 64th chapter of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, but the 125th chapter also, the words come through in a sense that there is a balance in the 12 signs, the 12 signs of the zodiac, that those constellations form a harmonic of the 12 signs of the way in which the path of the sun during a year will go through these 12 constellations. one found in the original hieroglyphic teaching about 5,000 years ago, 3,000 BC, that the sun is able to course not only through the day, but also through the night to rise again with the dawn of the next day, so that the sun's course in the starry field is the full day, and that that full day is able to be added to the full days that have occurred since the universe was formed, so that each new dawning day has increased tapas, which we are able to journey with, not just physically in our sense of holiness, our sense of respect, our sense of learning, but to higher tune that learning so that we are able in spirit to join with Ra through the netherworld night to rise again and enjoy the upper world day. And this joining of Ra in this way was always a quality where Ra is the radiance of the ninth. Our ability to appreciate in our man world, our human world, has constrictions because at the most it can be balanced by consciousness, but with nature. One cannot get rid of space-time and have a universe. The three levels are eternity, spontaneously making a natural cycle of the universe, which can be finally understood as a cosmos. And then the third is man understanding that his balance enables him to mature his spirit so that the spirit can join through the cosmos, celebrating the radiance that is eternally real. The beginning of this in 2000 BC was by Zarathustra, who was a contemporary of Abraham. Zarathustra wrote his gathas, which are spiritual songs of in praise of the holiness. And he was also about 75 years of age when he wrote them. And interestingly enough, he wrote them about the same time that Abraham got to the Promised Land. They were contemporaries. And Zarathustra by that time had moved from his Central Asian, Scythian origins south across the Amu Darya River, across a pass with the Hindu Kush, into what is today Afghanistan, into what is today Kabul. So that there was 4,000 years ago a new aeon where there was the origin of the Iranian sense of religion and the origin of the Jewish sense of religion tuned, paired. And not to know that is a very great ignorance indeed. It means that the current situation is actually demonically delusive rather than anything real. It does not have a psychic actuality to which it can refer, so that there is something called in Greek, the word is miasma. Miasma is a fog of sickness that covers not just your ability to perceive, but especially your ability to conceive, so that you do not have clear ideas, nor do you have clear seeing. And what suffers in this is that the character of one's real qualities is covered by this miasma, so that one is technically, in an analytic, sick. And being sick, one needs to be healed, so that one needs to find real physician, and that there is such a thing in civilization as a doctor of civilization, and that this is what the bodhisattvas do. And the origin of the bodhisattvas comes exactly at the same time. And you have to understand, carrier waves bring all of the resonances that belong together into a new harmonic. That's why they all appear at the same time. They are refreshed at the same time. But one has to have a higher learning than what was sufficient just a generation before, and maybe 1,000 years before, no longer is sufficient. One has to not only renew, but redo. The gathas, the holy songs of Zarathustra, in the first set of 7 yasnas, making a beautiful harmonic together, the origins actually of the sense of 7 being a holy structure, like a menorah. This is Zarathustra, in my translation, from the 30th yasna, the 11th hat, which in the 7, the original poetic is of 6 lines. The next 4, it goes to 5 lines. The third set is again a 4, where it's just 4 lines. And then the 4th set, making the quaternary, is just 1 yasna of 3 lines, but of twice the number of hats as the first set, so that you learn to spiritually pair, and you don't read the final 4th part of Zarathustra accurately until you can see, not just intuit, but you can appreciate, because you are remembering and creative imagining at the same time, so that it is that your consciousness now is not only differential in vision, and not only kaleidoscopic in history, but it becomes capable of being a poesis, that it creates along with remembering as you go. And this is the translation of these 6 lines. Whenever taught, the pairs understood, are Mazda gifts to those men, joys with sorrows delivering, meaning that lasts, harm to the false, and to the understanding followed truths indeed, each with other reach, common light. In the ancient Avestan language, it's not just common light, but it has an inflection which actually carries as ancient light. So that the epithet in high wisdom was always that Zarathustra was ancient light. We know now from late 20th century, early 21st century astronomy that our star, our sun, the light from our sun takes about 1,000,000 years to bubble up from the interior of the sun to reach the surface. And when it does, it magnetically jets itself out and becomes the solar wind. That light, we say, takes 8 minutes from the sun to reach our Earth. But that light was 1,000,000 years in the making in the sun, so that the light, not just of the day, being 1,000,000 years old just in this star system alone, but that that sun, that star of ours, has an age of 4.7 billion years. The cosmos has been around three times as long as that. So that when we talk about ancient light in a really vast harmonic of eternity, we mean ancient in that it does not have a time limit at all, which means that its space is not limited at all, which means that the space-time of the universe is able to be brought by pairs, by symmetries, by proportions, into a higher understanding. One of the phrases from the earliest Mahayana gatha, the Prajnaparamita Ratnaguna Samkhya gatha. The translator says the accumulation of precious qualities. Actually, it's the perfection of wisdom, capability through night, queen, wisdom, holy song of all understanding. That would be its technical understanding. Just a couple of lines. Just so the bodhisattva who is established in emptiness manifests manifold and various works to beings in the world. And his vows and cognitions are a force which sustains beings, but he does not experience the blessed rest, for emptiness is not a place to stand on. More after a break. Let's come back to Zarathustra. In Avestan, his name was pronounced Zarathustra. In Avestan, ancient Avestan, which was the first alphabetical language in Central Asia at the very same time that alphabets were developed in Phoenicia. The aspirated hustra is the word for camel, and Zarat is the word for good, meaning good with camels, meaning that he ran caravan routes. And they used camels because the caravan routes went all the way from the Caspian Sea area along the Amu Darya River basin into Tajikistan and over a pass and dropped down into the Gobi Desert and ran along the southern mountain range, the Kunlun Mountains, going all the way on a jade road through Khotan. Ancient Khotan was the way station oasis where two great rivers came down together and in ancient times, this is 4,000 years ago, actually watered a great deal of the Gobi Desert, which desiccated some while after that to the extent that it is now, and ran all the way into China, as far as the original Chang'an, which today, through many thousands of years, is called Xi'an, which is why they're developed in those huge caravan routes, just like with Sargon of Akkad's huge caravan routes, a sense of the higher resonances and higher harmonics that characterize human beings when you get a massive spread, a spectrum which almost very few people have ever been exposed to or privy to. Here's from the beginning of that yasna that I gave one hot quotation. Here are the first two, six lines each. Now I speak to you seekers in pairs. Mazda creates wisdom, and Ahura is the beginning of praise. While prayer is in vohu man nu, and insight moves as asha, as stars constellating paradise. Vohu man is good mind. Asha is feminine, and it's the true order. So that the good mind and the true order, vohu man and asha, are a pair. They're a symmetry. In Zarathustra, in the Gathas, it's always pairs of feminine and masculine. Just as good mind, vohu man, pairs with asha, the powerful courage to accept the challenge of life and being. In Avesta, that male spirit helper, they were called Amesha Spentas, they're guardian spirit guides. That courageous male to accept the challenges and difficulties was Kshatra. And Kshatra was tuned, paired with the feminine Armeti, which is real love in its full spectrum to the highest harmonics. Armeti and Kshatra, Vohuman and Asha. And then there was a pair that always are paired, they're never separated. Harvatat and Emeritat, the male and the female. The male was health. The female was eternal health. So that a physician has a wisdom feminine companion that makes the symmetry of medicine extend to permanent healing. Not so much permanent healing, but to the healing of the real. Here's the second of the Hats from Yasna 30 in my translation. Listen with inner ears best and see your aurora mind. Two ways differentiate by choice, each a person or an ego either. Before any great aeon happens, best for you, awaken each to teach. And the ancient understanding by that time began to surface. That if you learn to have that royal road access to differential conscious vision, being able to read an alphabetized written language is the royal road. And if you can read, then you can learn. And if you can write, then you can teach. One of the beautiful odes to Solomon by Mary Magdalene is Ode 20. And we need to understand a little bit, put a time form context on this. The odes to Solomon come 1,000 years after the Song of Solomon, which comes 1,000 years after Abraham, after Zarathustra. And the Song of Songs is by a woman. She was the queen of Sheba. Her personal name was Makeda. 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 Magdalene. There are sonorities. And just as the Song of Songs blends the feminine with the masculine in a high poetic, so too the Odes of Solomon have a blending, have this symmetry in a very high harmonic. And Ode 20, through the translation of James H. Charlesworth, very wonderful. He's spent the last 45 years working on this. I lifted up my arms on high on account of the compassion of the Lord, because he cast off my bonds from me, and my helper lifted me up according to his compassion and salvation, but put on the grace of the Lord generously and come into his paradise, and make for thyself a crown from his tree. Then put it on thy head and be joyful, and recline upon his rest. For his glory will go before thee, and thou shalt receive of his kindness and of his grace. And thou shalt be anointed in truth with the praise of his holiness, and praise and honor to his name. Hallelujah. These qualities of high poetic, spanning in this case from 2000 BC to 1000 BC to 0 BC, each one showing that there is not just a continuity, but there's an increasing energy, a tapas of time energy and of instantaneously then the energy of space, and then the high dharma of the energies of spiritual persons being able to be real even beyond the cosmos. Thus thrice greatest. The quality that's there in the 14th of the classic Hermetica, the Asclepius, is that the teaching that is coming through is actually called the, in translation, the perfect sermon, Sermo Telios. It is the perfection of a sermon, which one of the earlier Hermetica was called the general sermon, for just getting into the beginnings of being able to increase your hearing, to have ears to hear, or to access your reading, or better yet, having someone read out loud so that you hear what is written in a special way with a poetic, which means the poetic has a cadence. All of the early alphabetical written forms were in poetry. They all are poetic. And it has a spiritual contagious quality to it, so that 500 years after Zarathustra writing his gathas in Avestan, that ancient language went into a resonance, and one resonance went into ancient Iran as Old Persian emerged about 1500 BC, and in India through the Khyber Pass from Kabul, Afghanistan into northern India, Kashmir, ancient Gandhara, and even before that, it became Sanskrit. So that you have interesting things. In Sanskrit, I've all heard the term a mantra. In Avestan, it's mantra. It is something that one makes. And if you're close to folk people who are not used to relying upon reading and writing, they talk about making the language, making the words. In Chinese, when you begin to learn the traditional characters, it takes a long while for you to make the language. And when you do, the quality of your character comes through the making of it. So that there is such a thing as the art of calligraphy. And one can with great practice, learn to tune in to the spiritual character of the writer, so that there are specimens of calligraphy that are astounding. I will next week bring my Taoist degree in Chinese from my mentor in his own calligraphy, and you'll be able to see the Asha and the Vohoman, the clearness of mind and the order of the way in which a language is presented in its cadence, able to be put into the writing, so that the reading of the writing brings out the voice of that spirit person in all of its prismatic possibilities. I worked on making translations with him of classic Tang poetry of Li Po and Tu Fu, and he chose for my degree from him two of the poems of Tu Fu in a classic form. Each line is 5 characters, and there are 8 lines, so it's 40 character poems. And in the cadence, one learns that when you speak, even in a translation, a good translation, like from Chinese to English, you get the flavor. And the flavor is extraordinary for someone like Li Po or Tu Fu. But the most extraordinary thing is the ancient Chinese characters, some 1,500 years before the Tang Dynasty. And in that ancient Chinese, it's almost impossible to find someone who can read it out loud. But one thing emerges from it. When you look at the Chinese manuscript of the Tao Te Ching, there is no punctuation whatsoever. It's 5,500 characters, like a waterfall, like a cascade. And for someone to be able to have delivered that kind of a cascade is almost beyond belief. It is like being in a fresh mountain breeze that just blows all day long. That's the quality of the Tao Te Ching. When you get around to, again, or just doing, the learning civilization, the very last presentation, the interval for the 8th phase of science, is the Ratna Guna Samkhya Gatha, which is the first of the Prajnaparamita. And it's interesting to see that the 6 Amesha Spenta, the 6 holy spirits of Zarathustra, re-emerge in the Mahayana as the 6 paramitas, in 2 sets of triads. The first set can be taught to children. The second set, you have to learn beyond being an adult. The first 3, the very first one is dana, which translates as givingness. It's not just giving, it's gifting. It's the continuous quality of the perfection of giving, that one not just does this, but is this. And paired with that is the ancient Asha that becomes now Sila. It used to be translated as morality. It's beyond morality. It's the perfection of the order that allows for the seamless confluence of life in the quality of plants and animals, minerals, metals, beings, spirits. And with Sila and with Dana, there's Kshanti, which basically would translate as patience. But it's the capital P, the patience of Job. the patience to not just endure whatever happens, even to the tragedy of losing everything. And then having those who come to counsel you and criticize you for having done something secret that you're not admitting, as Job's detractors do. God will not cause evil. You must have done something. What was it? Let's get to it. And in the book of Job, Job's patience endures until all of the probings and arguments of the detractors are shown to evaporate, and that Job is still there. And that's when the spirit comes out of the whirlwind and says that Job has never been severed from me. And everything is restored in double to him. It's that quality of Kshanti and of Sila and of Dana that mature in the paramitas. And it is Dana, the givingness, the giftingness, that matures into prajna, into wisdom. It is Sila that matures finally into Dhyana, which doesn't mean meditation so much as it means the constellation of meditation. The third is that Kshanti, patience, matures into virya, into the, we get the word virile from that, the virility of life, is that its patience, like the patience of Job, can mature to perfection. And the virya and the dhyana and the prajna, as the three higher paramitas, bring the character that has been nourished by the first three perfections into a spirit person. That spirit person now is super nourished into eternity and become helpers as well, become healers as well. And it is this quality that becomes interesting when we see how everything got constellated about 90 AD, 90 CE, like that. Through the entire swath of that world was a sea change in that particular year, all tied together. The trigger for that was the crisis in the far west country of Britain, in its adjuncts with Wales, adjuncts with Ireland, with southern Scotland. The entirety of what we would see as the Irish Sea, the mouths of the Severn. The tragedy that struck there was that the mitochondrial DNA of the Holy Family was ended. Without the, and you write it in genetics, mtDNA. The mitochondrial DNA is only passed on by the women. Men cannot pass that on. The carrier of that mitochondrial DNA was, of course, the mother, and then her four daughters received it, three of whom had children. But they were all male except one was female. The mother of that female was Susanna, and her mother was Mary the mother, of course. And her daughter was Anna. And Anna was an extraordinary woman. Both of her sons became kings, one the king of England, the other the king of France. And the third married the king of the whole Irish Sea. He was the Fisher King. And she was excellent and beautiful. And after having raised three children beautifully, she was commandeered and kidnapped by a very powerful warlord and forced to live with him and have two sons by him. Her daughter was named Branwen, and she is the trigger of the tragedy, not because of something she did, but of what she suffered. She was married to an Irish king who then turned against her because of listening to massive, illusional, delusional slander. And she was taken from being queen to being scrubbing pots in the kitchen, like Cinderella in reverse. She was rescued by her older brother, Bran, and his seven knights. But so many people died that she died of a broken heart. And the lineage came to an end, symbolized by a family heirloom, which was the cup of the wine from the Last Supper. And so Bran and his uncle, a brother of Anna named Joseph, took the cup back to the Holy Land. And by that time, by 90 AD, there was almost nothing that could be done to keep it anywhere but in Antioch. And that's where a container for it was made. That cup became the Grail. And the Grail quest is the almost unending nostalgia for something lost that is more important than importance, more significant than significance. But when it reappeared in the Alexandria, Antioch, Aegean, Palestine, ethos, when people understood what had happened, 90 AD became a trigger that spread this tragedy. And the great religions began to break off in their seeds. In Palestine, in Jamnia, a council was held and rabbinic Judaism was made on the basis that there will be no more changes to the Torah, to the Old Testament, and what came out was the Masoretic text, which is today exactly every iota, every dot that it was in 90 AD, 90 CE. At the same time, in Alexandria, the realization was that we need to have a way to ensure that the original way of the wisdom teachings is preserved. And so the Hermetica were begun that very same year. And in India, the very first of the great books on the Mahayana by Asvaghosha, whose name means Asva in Sanskrit is horse, so that it is the sound of the horse whinnying. It's a great victory cry. It's like Jesus saying of the two brothers, James and John, he used the Greek term boinergeres, which is Homeric, and it is not a word so much as a victory cry in the Iliad, that when you have the victory, the great warriors cry out, and it's their crying out that is like thunder. So it's not that they're sons of thunder, it's that they're sons of the victory that will be real. At the same time as the Mahayana is born, And its title in English, Asvaghosha's book, is The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. You can go through every sutra of Buddhism, you will not find faith. It's not something that can be awakened. In fact, in the traditional Buddhism, there is no such thing as awakening to faith. There's awakening to moksha. There's no need to have faith. In what? For what? For whom? Yet, paradoxically and symmetrically, Asvaghosha patiently, incredibly brilliantly, shows that this is equally real. That because there is no place to stand means that in unboundedness, you are more than you are being are. The quality that split off and became the Mahayana versus the old Buddhism, the Judaism splitting off from the developments of Hellenistic Judaism for several centuries, the beginnings of a Christianity that is not the way so much, but is the protection of the formality of those guarding you against these kinds of incursions. The beginnings of a churchiness. And in the Celtic, the beginnings of the unending quest that someone will be able to come and find that. That there is somewhere then, in the ethos of challenge, there must be a Grail castle. And there must be a knight as able to go there and be successful at that. All of that in 500 years cycles of the Phoenix matured in the Celtic world with King Arthur. And King Arthur's round table, every knight at the round table was an inheritor of the masculine DNA from the Holy Family. None of them had the feminine mitochondrial, but they all had the masculine lineage. But at the round table, there was a chair that was left open. That place is, in Arthurian parlance, the siege perilous. You have to be aware that this is perilous to try and occupy that seat. In Judaism, it's called the chair of Elijah. Only someone who is Elijah-ness could sit in that seat. Because the peril is, if you are not perfected in that way, it will ratchet and work in the exact opposite and become demonic. Yeah. And if you think you have problems, those are problems, indeed. The way in which Asclepius is symbolized is that he has a cypress staff, and there's a single serpent wrapped around that staff, and you'll see on medical buildings that that's the symbol of medicine, of a medical enclave. The original to that are enclaves that were called Asclepions, the temples of Asclepius. And the first time in Greece that there is a temple of Asclepius is 1500 BC. We keep running across these time forms that separate in a geometry and parallels and lead us to the ability to have an aesthetic and an analytic consciously of where we are, why, and when it is, and who it is that we are doing this. And that when we do this continuously, those questions get absorbed into an infinite field and a zero field, and those fields come into such a pre-configuration that the zero field is fertile, and spontaneously time begins, and instantly phenomena like space occur, and here we are. More next week.